Okay,
So I just want to give you a...
Yeah, you too.
There we go. Happy New Year, everyone, 2016. I hope you all had a wonderful holiday. I certainly had a wonderful Christmas with my grandkids. They moved from Arizona to Chicago, so it was my first Christmas in Chicago, Illinois, and that was an experience. All right, I would like to open the Senate Interim Committee on Healthcare. It is Wednesday, January 13th, and we're going to start out with informational hearings, and I'd like to call Pat Allen up to talk to us about giving us an update on the health insurance marketplace.
Thanks. Good morning, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, the now proud owner of the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace. This is our third opportunity during the interim to come to you and provide an update on how things are going. I'll talk briefly about three things: our financial performance to date, and current enrollment numbers, and our outreach activities, and then spend a little bit of time on new information since the last time we came and reported to you, which is the proposed federal charge for use of their technology platform and some of what we're doing in response to that. First, in terms of financial performance, I'm pleased to say almost all of our budget numbers turn out to be wrong. All of our expenses are lower than we expected. Our revenues are higher than we expected. The ending fund balance that we inherited from Cover Oregon was lower than expected because they prepaid a large portion of technology costs before they wound down. And so we're operating at or above all of the financial parameters we expect for the exchange. And in fact, we'll be shortly in a condition where we'll need to be looking at a mechanism to reduce our ending fund balance because it will be over the statutory maximum provided for the program. So from a financial standpoint, I think we're in very good shape. From an enrollment standpoint, the numbers that we have right now are actually very, very good. As of January 2nd, and these numbers come out weekly, we should get numbers later today. I don't expect them to change a lot, and I'll explain that in a minute. We have just short of 134,000 enrollees on the health insurance marketplace. That compares to 112,000 enrollees for all of open enrollment last year. That's about an 18% increase with about 3 weeks, 4 weeks to go from that date. Couple of things that we will expect to change with those enrollment numbers as we get to the end of open enrollment. They'll creep up a little bit until we get to the last week, and then, not surprisingly, since that's when the deadline is, we expect there will be something of a spike. And because that's the gross enrollment, we expect then the final numbers will drop somewhat from that because we'll shift from raw enrollment to what we call effectuated coverage. That's the people who actually paid their premiums and their coverage went into effect. And historically, that's about 85% of the total who sign up, who end up making that coverage effective. So if unless we see something surprising in terms of a much lower effectuation rate, which we don't anticipate, we should see enrollment that is significantly higher this year than it was last year. I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the outreach. Oh, and then just a couple of comparators. Oregon now has the third highest increase over last year's enrollment in the country. We are the second highest in the country for enrolling the percentage of eligible uninsured in the state. And so, in terms of just thinking about the basic objectives of why we're doing a health insurance marketplace to get people coverage, I think by all measures, the team at the health insurance marketplace have done an outstanding job, and those metrics are all good. I'd like to, pardon me, to talk a little bit about some of that work. We're doing a number of outreach efforts, largely in partnership with others, particularly the agent community, community of sisters, communities of faith, those kinds of things. As you know, we don't have a significant staff directly at the marketplace. We operate with a much, much smaller staff than Cover Oregon did for a variety of reasons, and so these are all partnership efforts. But in this last 2 weeks of open enrollment, for instance, we're doing community college storming, aiming particularly at the very important 18 to 34 market. As an aside, about 25% of our enrollment in Oregon is in that 18 to 34 age group, which is a very encouraging statistic that keeps us out of
who has enrolled now.
Right. Oh. Yeah, about 25% young people. And so we're focusing efforts at community colleges to get those folks out. We're working in partnership with a number of business organizations, the Real Estate Association, Trucking Association, agencies like the Construction Contractors Board, Board of Tax Preparers, BOLI, the Employment Department on targeted outreach to sectors that typically have insurance coverage kinds of issues for employees. We've also been able to work with Department of Human Services to get access to contact information for SNAP recipients. This is the food assistance program, often known as food stamps, who are not eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. So that's an incredibly targeted list who have high rates of uninsurance and qualification for tax credits. And so we're doing targeted outreach there. We're working with emergency rooms, benefit coordinators at hospitals, urgent care providers who are often at the front lines of finding people who don't have insurance coverage to make sure they're aware of the options that are available to them. We're also doing some work, fortunately, in the economy we're in right now, we're not in a circumstance with there being lots of identifiable layoff kinds of circumstances, but we're getting in front of folks who are affected by layoffs to be able to talk to them about the marketplace as a potentially much more cost-effective alternative to COBRA coverage offered by their employer. And that, of course, losing a job is an opportunity to sign up for coverage through the marketplace outside of open enrollment. Those are some examples of the kinds of things that we've been focusing on in outreach. And those are examples particularly of the kinds of things that being a state marketplace allows us to do and to tailor to Oregonians and to tailor to the needs of our marketplaces, the places where we think people who need coverage are most likely to be in those kinds of issues. And that falls really outside of what the federal government invests primarily in mass market media. We'll be coming back in February during the short session, as required by a budget note, to talk much more extensively about our marketing and outreach efforts and paid and earned media particularly, and talk about some metrics that were associated with that. But I wanted to give you some flavor of what we're doing in those areas. So let me take a couple of minutes and talk about the federal charge for its platform. As you, of course, know, beginning with last year's open enrollment, when we abandoned the Oracle Cover Oregon platform, we moved to use of healthcare.gov for enrollments for last year and for this year, and that was at no charge from the federal government for that platform. We always knew that circumstance would end and there would be a charge. They have now released a rule. And that rule proposes a fee of 3% of premium for use of their platform. Now, a couple of pieces of information for context. Just to be extra confusing, we denominate our charges in terms of per member per month dollars, $9.66 per member per month. Theirs is in terms of percentage of premium. So that's a little bit confusing. We roughly equate our $9.66 per member per month to about 2.9% of premium. So they're talking about charging above and beyond what we're already charging, more or less about the same dollar amount. Also for context, if you are just playing a federal marketplace state with no state involvement at all, the charge is 3.5%. So they're basically saying 85% of the cost that they charge insurers goes to their technology platform. That fee is higher than we anticipated, and so we're trying to figure out how we're going to need to react to that. There's a statutory cap on what we can charge of 5% of premium. As proposed, the federal charge wouldn't actually flow through us, so from a technical standpoint, it wouldn't be covered by that 5% premium, but certainly the spirit of that guideline is that the total cost of the system ought to be under 5%, and that's certainly the target that that we would want to be paying close attention to. If we do nothing, we'd be looking at about 6% of premium, which would be above that, and so we would have to look at some choices of what we would do to reduce the Oregon portion of that cost. Now, our overperforming in terms of number of enrollees helps offset that and allows us to fund that cost at a lower rate, but we'll need to come back to you and talk about some programmatic changes that we would need to make that go at some of those outreach kinds of functions particularly that I was talking about. The other thing that we have done, and I really want to make sure to be clear about this, we have issued a request for proposals for two different technology platforms, one for the small business or shop platform and one for an individual platform. Now, the news coverage was sometimes great and sometimes not so helpful, sort of in the there they go again, but this time it'll work kind of a vein, which is not at all what we have in mind for this. I consider our doing this RFP to be due diligence at its most basic level. If we simply stay with the federal platform, that means we're sending $13 to $15 million of insurance ratepayer dollars to Washington, D.C. And before I come back and tell you I think that's a good idea and here's how we should cut our program to match that, I think I have an obligation to at least figure out what would alternatives to that cost. And those alternatives in the request for proposal that we have done are very strictly defined as operating systems being used by other states up and running that we can that we could conceivably go on to or implement as being used in other states, not a code writing exercise where you hire a vendor to come and design you a from scratch system. Now, I think it's entirely likely that when we get the responses to those to that request at the end of this month, we'll find that there's not some huge cost savings available to go with some sort of a vendor platform, and so we'll have answered that question and we'll be able to come back and talk about the trade-offs inherent with using the federal platform. It's also possible that there may be vendor solutions that are proven technology that may offer some sort of a compelling argument that I can come and make to you. And make to the governor's office and to our advisory committee, which will be up and running after the February short session, that will cause us to say, yeah, it makes sense for us to want to operate a state-based platform. That case would need to be compelling for me to want to even have that conversation with anybody.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Senator.
Thank you very much. Mr. Allen, one of the things we've done after of the prior transition is switch our Medicaid through to the Kentucky system, and that apparently has gone very smoothly.
Uh-huh.
Thank you to our team doing that, and in particular Ms. Miller, who's supervised that. Some states still run their own exchanges, their own homegrown exchanges for their commercial market.
Washington, for example.
Is there an opportunity to piggyback on the way we have with our Medicaid system enrollment?
With our system, with the OHA system, or with other states?
No, for the commercial market, because our concern, you're saying, and I agree with you, that you have to figure out what the most efficient and cost-effective way to make sure that people can continue with open enrollment in Oregon without it costing an arm and a leg. And I heard you say you put out an RFP to companies, and it seems like there may be a third option, which is to partner with a state that has its own exchange. And I just wonder whether that was potentially an option as
yes,
well.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Senator Hayward, absolutely. In fact, I have reason to believe that one or more states may respond to our request for proposals, or vendors in partnership with the states with which they currently work may propose. We've had some casual conversations along some of those lines in the time leading up to the release for the RFP, and so absolutely those were the kinds of options that we would definitely consider.
Thank you.
And I was reading that one of the states back east is going to get rid of their exchange after 2016. I thought it was Kentucky.
It is Kentucky.
Is that going to affect our use of their system, or is that a vendor?
Well, so that system is being used by Oregon Health Authority, and they would be better able to speak authoritatively than I, but my understanding of that is that what we got from Kentucky was the code for the system being used by Kentucky, brought it to Oregon, and then worked with a vendor to modify it to meet our needs. And so what we have is an independent system. It's not directly related to service provision from Kentucky, but again, OHA can speak much more authoritatively to that than I can.
Thank you.
And that really concludes what I wanted to say about that. More to come when we come back in February, because we will have at least the raw proposals from that RFP and be able to begin to have a policy conversation about what we think the going forward path might look like. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Yes, Senator Knope.
Thanks, Director. For the people in the health insurance marketplace, how many of those are on subsidies, and do we have an idea of the average subsidy that occurs with those folks?
Yeah, I'm just trying to see if I have specific data, and I don't think I do right here. The percentage who are qualifying for subsidies is around 70 to 75%. I don't have, but I can certainly get for you what the average subsidy is, certainly for this year that we're currently in.
Right.
Not for the open enrollments going on right now.
Thank you.
And a caveat to all this, I have from constituents. Of course, I live in an area where there was a lot of underinsured. I'm getting people saying this is a godsend for them. Many of them have never had insurance before. And so even though there have been some bumps, the end result is that there are a lot of people now getting access and getting health care that they didn't get just because they didn't have insurance.
I think that's right, Chairman Sanderson. And I think the other point is that the consumers of insurance, people are now coming to their second or third year around and being able to buy insurance, and they're becoming more sophisticated consumers. They're learning things like the cheapest bronze plan doesn't provide access to cost-sharing assistance with deductibles and copays and those kinds of things that are available in certain silver plans, and we're seeing a shift out of both ends of the market toward those silver plans that often that really go at the issue that you hear of, well, now I'm paying all this money for insurance and I still can't go to the doctor because I got this big copay. Well, for a lot of people, there are policies to buy that work through that issue, and the consumers are beginning to recognize that and shop accordingly, which I think is a great outcome.
Great. Any other? All right.
Thank you so much.
Okay, now we're going to have an update on opioids. Dr. Katrina Hedberg from the Oregon Health Authority.
Yes, thank you. And I assume I drive the slides. I'm just kidding. Is that right? Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Katrina Hedberg, and I am the State Health Officer with the Public Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm here to provide a little bit of an update about the activities that we're involved with related to opioid overdose prevention. So the problem of prescription opioids, it's been a problem nationwide here in Oregon as well. In 2014, there were 154 Oregonians who died of prescription opioids. The rate of these opioid overdose deaths has declined recently, and I'll show a slide in a minute about that. So that's sort of the good news, but the bad news is that we still have a number of people who are affected by this. In 2013, there were 330 Oregonians who were hospitalized for opiate overdose, and the cost of their care was $9.1 million. In addition, so that's sort of directly related to opioid overdose, we also had 3,400 people who were hospitalized for treatment of opioid use disorder. In Oregon, we have over 200,000, or 5% of the population, self-report non-medical use of opioids or prescription pain relievers. And so this is actually the second highest in the country for this self-reported use of non-medical use of pain relievers.
And Dr. Could you please remind us exactly what is an opioid? I mean, which drugs are considered opioids?
Yes, Chair Mona Sanderson. It's actually a very broad classification. It's drugs, obviously, that have been derived initially from the opiate or the opium poppy, but now, of course, they're synthetic drugs. And it's everything from Tylenol 3 to OxyContin, Vicodin, et cetera. It's a very broad class of medications. But it needs to be distinguished from other psychotropic, the benzodiazepines, things like Valium, et cetera, are in a different class of medication. But all of these are controlled substances, and so you need to have not only a prescription, but someone who's prescribing them needs to have be registered a physician or a nurse practitioner with the Drug Enforcement Agency at the federal level.
Thank you.
If I may, yes. Madam Chair. So just to clarify then, Dr. Hedberg, this plan is specifically around opioids. It's not around misuse of benzodiazepines or other substances that we know can be problematic.
Yep. So Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Steiner Hayward, it's actually broader to that. We are focusing because right now there is an issue that we're seeing with opioids. And actually that, so that's when we get into things like chronic pain, and the treatment of chronic pain is usually what opiates are used initially for, acute pain, and then people develop addiction to them or the sort of chronic use. So we're focused on that, but it's clear that this needs to be done in concert with other types of medications such as benzodiazepines. So some of the tools that we have, and I'll talk about those in a minute, do relate to other classes such as the benzodiazepines. It's so again, for us, it isn't that it's only one medication. In fact, the issue is that as soon as you tamp down on any particular class, you might see an increase in a different type of medication. And so for me, the issue is really, what is it that people are dying of, and how do you prevent that, not that it's a problem with any specific medication. Obviously, when we identify, and some years ago there was a problem with OxyContin, and people were using, these are supposed to be slow-release tablets, and instead they were crushing them and using them, we're seeing a number of deaths. So that can be an issue that comes to light with a particular medication. But frankly, it's not just the one medication that's the problem. It's the whole policy that that's being used, what they're being treated for, et cetera. So this slide actually brings that point to light. The top line are the prescription opioid overdoses, and you can see that they peaked in Oregon around 2006, 2007, and have gradually declined. That's the good news. In other states, they've seen a concomitant increase in the heroin overdose deaths. We have not seen that in Oregon, but it also hasn't declined. So again, the good news is that those lines haven't crossed, which they have in some states. On the other hand, it hasn't gone down either. So we are continuing to have a problem with heroin overdose deaths. And again, when we looked, there was a recent Centers for Disease Control, the MMWR, the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, looked at all drugs, including the benzodiazepines, and saw that around the country there had been an increase in the overdose deaths due to that. So again, that brings the point that we're not just concerned about a specific medication, but rather the class. So help address the issue, we developed, this is an OHA, what we call the Oregon Opioid Initiative or Prevention Initiative. And of course, the goals, hopefully you'll recognize, sort of fall along the lines of the triple aim, improving overall population health by decreasing overdose deaths, decreasing hospitalizations and emergency department visits related to opioid overdose, and decreasing opioid misuse. Improving the quality of care, that is pain management practice, so that we make sure that it isn't just opioids that are being used to treat pain, but a broader treatment plan, including the use of alternative pain therapies. And increasing availability of medication-assisted treatment for those people who are chronic opioid users or have an opioid use disorder. And then, of course, the idea here is that we would decrease these hospitalizations and the healthcare costs related to these overdoses. So the thing about opioids, and again, it gets to your question a minute ago, is it's really there, unfortunately, there isn't sort of one thing that we can do and it's going to solve the problem. It really involves a spectrum of interventions and also a spectrum of partners, and I'll get to that towards the end. But the way I look at it is there's too many medications being prescribed, too many drugs out there, and so we really need to sort of decrease the amount of opiates that are being prescribed, and we also need, for ones that have not been used, need to have, for example, not only safe storage, but safe disposal of medications. So that's one piece of it. Then for those who overdose, we need to have the availability of naloxone or Narcan, which of course is an antidote to opiates specifically. And then for folks who are using these on a chronic basis, make sure that we have availability of treatment for opioid misuse disorders. And then, of course, we're using data to help target and evaluate the variety of interventions. So I'll talk a little bit more about each of these specifically. So when we're talking about decreasing the amount of opioids prescribed, I think it's important for us to understand that this involves, again, a variety of interventions. What's been successful in parts of the state, for example, Jackson County, about 5 years ago, developed some opioid prescribing guidelines and have been in the process of implementing those. Washington State is way out in front of this. And some other regions of Oregon have done that at a regional level. Recently, the Center Centers for Disease Control came out with national guidelines, and those are in a comment period right now. But guidelines are one thing. Of course, how you actually implement them is another.
Doctor, it points out your comment about the various guidelines that are out points out a significant issue for prescribing providers, which is that there are often multiple guidelines, and it's hard to know which ones are best. I don't know when the right time is for you to comment on this, but I'd be curious to know how the ones that we've come up with in Oregon jibe with the Washington ones and the ones that have recently been issued by the CDC, because disagreement among guidelines makes it really tough for prescribing providers.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Steiner Hayward, that's a very good question. I was hoping, I actually have a slide, but I don't have it in my talk today, that specifically relates to Oregon guidelines. I'll talk about that a little bit more at the end. We do not have statewide guidelines so far. But there have been, I mentioned, in several regions have developed their own guidelines. And Washington State, the Centers for Disease Control, there are others out there. There is a spectrum of things that need to be covered in these guidelines. So certainly the amount of drug is one of them. But it also talks a lot about the variety of things that need to be done, including assessing the patients and making sure they have access to alternative. And I had mentioned a minute ago about having a treatment plan that they're referring to. And it has the Oregon College of Emergency Physicians has come up with emergency room guidelines. So, again, concerns about patient, if you will, doctor shopping or going to many different emergency departments instead having the pain being treated in the primary care setting. Those are some examples of the issues that need to be covered by these guidelines. But your point is very well taken. I think, again, there's two points. What I say is that actually writing the guidelines is easy because I can just take one of them that are out there and put our logo on it. But that doesn't actually help. It's how you implement them and how that influences practice that's happening at the various settings, whether it's the emergency department, the primary care, pain management, et cetera. So getting buy-in from a variety of groups is very important. And that's part of the reason we will be launching a group to look at developing Oregon guidelines, but we anticipate that that will take perhaps the next 6 to 9 months to actually be able to get guidelines for what those would look like. Again, the Oregon specific, but as you mentioned, to have them as consistent as possible so that people aren't looking at this one says, you know, chart this way or up this way or the maximum dose is this or do that, and the other one says, well, slightly less or more or whatever, and people don't know what to follow. So the guidelines, just very briefly, I think all of us have had opiates at some point. Most people are first exposed to them when they get their wisdom teeth out as teenagers, are in a lot of pain. But they are very, very effective for treating acute pain. Opioids are also very effective for end-of-life care. People, we obviously, if people are dying, we don't want people to be dying in pain. If they've got cancer would be another example. So the issue that we're really looking at is chronic non-cancer pain. Things like lower back pain or other pains are the issue that we really have to figure out different ways to manage that pain other than opioids, because again, that's part of what's contributing to these overdose hospitalizations and deaths. And as I mentioned a minute ago, the guidelines have to address what's happening in primary care. I didn't put pain management up here, emergency departments. Post-hospitalization, again, it's not just getting people these medications, but what's the amount of them? How many refills are there? So what's the overall quantity? So again, it's a balance because we don't want people to be in pain. On the other hand, we want that pain to be managed in ways other or that include opiates perhaps initially, but in other forms later on.
Dr. Hedberger, have you seen physicians, or maybe Dr. Steiner Hayward can answer this too, regarding exercise? It's not very often that a physician will actually prescribe or to their patient to exercise, and it's research shows that just exercising, especially for back pain, makes a big difference in many cases. I wouldn't say all cases, but many cases. And I know it's easier to prescribe a pill and prescribe a device. Do you know much about that research?
Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Hedberger. I would say two things. I think that the literature on this has become more and more obvious. There was, you may well be alluding to a study that just came out this week on prevention of recurrent low back pain through exercise prescription. Anecdotally, from my work supervising residents in training, I will say that I'm seeing it more among our younger physicians. And in fact, at least at OHSU, they've integrated, you can actually prescribe exercise as an order in our electronic health record system. So just in the same way you would prescribe a pill, you can prescribe that. You can prescribe certain kinds of a diet through our system as well now, too, so that it's taken as seriously as a pill prescription and it becomes a part of the patient's permanent record in a searchable way. So, yeah.
So, Madam Chair, some of the issues, of course, are, you know, again, the prescription, I won't say is easy, but that's the easiest part of it, and making sure that people follow through. Physical therapy would be another aspect because, of course, a lot of physical therapy is teaching people what are the different exercises that they should use. But that's an example of the variety of non-medical or medicine, I should say, modalities that should be used for these things. And in my mind, it's really how do we manage pain so that people can obviously lead full lives, not so much that the pain will be necessarily totally alleviated. I know that lower back pain, unfortunately, many, many folks suffer from it, among other types of chronic pain, and it really is how to decrease that in a way that people can manage the pain on an ongoing basis. Again, looking, you know, with everything, their side effects, and we're talking now about the side effects of these chronic medications. But for the others, it may be that the pain isn't totally gone, but it's manageable and they can continue to lead full lives. So we do, in the public health division, we manage the prescription drug monitoring program, and that's a useful tool to help assess, again, whether patients are getting multiple prescriptions from multiple providers and how much over what period of time. So that's another tool to help prescribing physicians and other clinicians, at least in determining how many medications their patient has gotten. And then, of course, it's also providing reimbursement for a variety of these things. So as you mentioned, a prescription may be the easy thing, but we need to be sure that the system allows that other things that have been prescribed, in fact, are also covered by insurance. So there's a role for pharmacies as well, things like prior authorization of medication. So we sort of think about what are the various points. It's at the point the prescription is being written, obviously, and then it's also at the point where the prescriptions are being dispensed. So we're looking at a variety of tools for providers as well as pharmacists. Pharmacists are the primary group that report into the prescription drug monitoring program. So they are at the time a prescription is dispensed. Pharmacies could also implement, for example, some limits in dispensing the amount of medications or how many refills or those kinds of things, and providing some feedback to providers because it may be that a single provider isn't aware that a patient has gotten multiple prescriptions from various providers. Again, these are multiple tools that could be used. And then information on safe drug storage as well as medication take-back, and that would be not only for opiates, the medication take-back, but for other medications such as antibiotics. We don't want those on people. Actually, we want someone to take all the antibiotics that they've been prescribed. But so I had mentioned naloxone. We want to increase the availability of naloxone, and there are certain patients who are potentially at higher risk who've gotten multiple prescriptions in the past on relatively high levels, have other comorbidities, and prescribing naloxone to those patients at the time that opioids are prescribed. So naloxone is something, obviously, that if a patient has overdosed, it needs to be someone near them who is helping to administer that to the patient. And we're looking at various options to allow the naloxone prescribing at the pharmacy level. So, again, there are some issues about should it be over-the-counter or behind-the-counter or whatever, but having that availability at the pharmacy level for people or family or friends, et cetera, who know someone who is a high user of opioids, having that naloxone available to them, it would be useful. improving infrastructure for the rescue by EMTs as well in law enforcement, because in some communities, the law enforcement are the folks who are really at the community level and are a first responder when it comes to this. And then we recently, as of January 1st, we now have a Good Samaritan law in Oregon, which allows, again, if you have two users, for example, heroin users, and one of them has overdosed, that they can call 911, and the friend or the person who hasn't overdosed will not be arrested for drug-related crimes after they're calling 911.
Yes.
Just quickly, I you may well be aware of this already, but Representative Buehler plans to introduce a bill this session to also allow family members of users to get one prescription of naloxone covered by insurance on an annual basis unless they can document that they used it to save somebody who had overdosed. And, you know, we already do that for other things, but to have family members, because that's often the people who are the closest to them, especially for prescription drugs as opposed to heroin. So I think that's going to be an additional tool in our kit, and it'll be very important as well.
So. Yes, thank you. So medication-assisted treatment. We, unfortunately, I'll show a slide in just a minute, do not have a uniform access to medication-assisted treatment throughout Oregon. And traditionally, this was what you thought of with heroin addicts having something like methadone, that it's not just behavioral, but there's actually medication that at this point there are additional medications that can be prescribed for that. And we need to be sure that we have the services available throughout the state of Oregon that are coordinated care organizations and others are involved in making sure that patients are enrolled and that medication-assisted treatment is covered. And it's a little complicated about who can prescribe this and who can treat patients in terms of both initiation and then in terms of maintenance, et cetera. But at this point, physicians, in order to do this, have to get a waiver from CMS to provide this medication. Buprenorphine is one of them. And there's a limit on the number. And so, again, that needs to be worked at the federal level, that there might be physicians who would actually want to see more patients than they're currently allowed to see. So, again, we're working on a number of areas for this. So this shows where those medication-assisted treatment programs exist in Oregon. You can see there's a number of them in the metropolitan area. Obviously, about half the state lives in the metropolitan area, so that's not surprising. There are a few in the valley. There are none in the coast or east of the mountains at all. And so this is really a problem, that if there's someone who lives in these other parts of the state who wants access, these are very long drives, as we know, in order to get to some of these programs. So even if things are covered, et cetera, just having access to these services is extremely important. So I think it's really important, again, as an epidemiologist, it's important for me to look at what the data are and who's being affected by these things in order to help guide what interventions we have as well as evaluate them. And so on an ongoing basis, we are going to be looking at, I mentioned overdose deaths and hospitalizations, and I could tell you that even though my graph looked pretty good, I'm going to update that to now include the increase of deaths that we're seeing from psychotropic medications, because it doesn't work to just focus on one and not focus on all of them. So this actually gets to Senator Steiner Hayward's question about what are the guidelines. One of the things that people focus on, again, the guidelines address all kinds of things, but the specific thing that people really focus on is the morphine equivalent dose that people get daily. And this cutoff of 120 milligrams is what has been used in other parts of the state. The Centers for Disease Control is currently proposing 90 milligrams, which is much lower than that. So again, for the purposes of this slide, it's not to make a comment on what should that amount be, but rather we really need to track what's the percentage of patients that are above some kind of threshold and monitor that over time, as well as the treatment data. And again, we do, we need to present these data by region of the state, by age. I think it comes often as a surprise. People think about heroin addicts as being young adults and they're dying from it. A lot of the people with overdose death are actually people my age and middle age who have a number of sort of chronic pains, ailments, it may be, and our veteran population coming back with a number of injuries that then are on chronic. These folks are on chronic medications they're the folks that are affected often by these.
Yes.
Thank you. Dr. Hedberg, you've mentioned several times during your testimony the importance of alternative therapies to manage chronic pain, and I think the evidence basis for that is actually very good. I know that the health authority, the Medicaid program, made a decision as part of this effort to cover a lot of alternative modalities that it has not historically covered, specifically for the purpose of treatment of chronic pain and under appropriate guidelines. Do you have any sense about whether the commercial insurers are following suit if, for example, acupuncture isn't normally a covered benefit on someone's plan, if it's being used to treat chronic pain under appropriate guidelines? Has that become a covered benefit, or is that impossible for you all to know?
So, Chairman Sanderson, Senator Snyder-Hayward, it's an excellent question, and I really don't know. We have not contacted each of them to find out what is covered in terms of those alternate. I'm assuming physical therapy is relatively standard, but some of the other modalities that you were referring to, I don't know. You know, as a state employee, I do get a benefit for, or I get some money back for working out, going to exercise at a club.
Right.
That has a number of benefits. That's an incentive. But I do not know what happens in other plans. That's an excellent question. And at this point, we can't really tell.
Thank you.
Dr. Hedberg,
yeah.
When getting back to the dose amount, it's hard for me to relate that you would tell someone how much they could prescribe when individuals react so differently to various types of medication. I mean, even psychotropic meds. This is not my area of expertise, but I would think the size of a person and the age of the person, as well as something innately different genetically that would cause them to need, say, 120 milligram versus 90 milligram. I don't know.
Feel free if you want to start. I can add on.
So, Chairman Sanderson, I think the issue is not what is the amount that's appropriate kind of out of the gate. If somebody has surgery, if somebody has acute trauma, you need to have very high doses. So that's, or large amounts. But again, this would kill me. So, you know, for a person who has not used medication or has been exposed to very much opiates over time, this is really, this is an issue. So our thought is not what the amount is that a person gets sort of initially. And we know that when people are treated with pain, for example, when my son was born, I had to have a cesarean section, and I had one of those little pain pumps, that when people control that kind of thing themselves in the hospital, they actually use less medication than if. But then, once I go home, a few meds, and then, you know, I'm done after a few days. So the issue here is not what's being used to treat acute pain. The question is chronic. And the problem with opiates, of course, is that people get
tolerant.
Thank you. Yeah, mm-hmm. Tolerant to them. And so they have to increase the dose more and more over time to get the same level of pain control. And so that's really the issue that we're talking about with chronic use. It's not whether or not you gauge, do I need one Tylenol 3 or 2 after I've had a procedure or whatever. That's not the issue. It's how many medications they get over a period of time. And in order for someone to be on this high a dose, they would have had to have worked up to it on a chronic basis.
Gotcha.
And if I may add just
Please.
Briefly, the tolerance is both physiologic and psychological. And people, understandably, chronic pain is scary. And it makes people, understandably, very anxious. And if you're trying very hard to avoid it, you can get to a point where you think you need more pain medication than you do. And so tapering people down, I'm seeing a lot of success in the patients in our practice. Actually, most people are going along quite happily and being very successful in tapering down to get down to lower doses. Even if they have to stay on an opioid on a chronic basis, they're on a much lower dose than they've been on. And most people are responding really well because they're being given hope that they can get their pain controlled in other ways.
Okay, so I think I've got a couple more slides here, but this is only to say that this, even though I've been talking about some of the activities that we're doing, I really see that the role of the Public Health Division is as a convener. So we're working a lot with other parts of OHA that are very involved in this. We have, as well as with other partners, and so just to give examples, we, around the guidelines, obviously we need to be working with the Medical Association. We're working with the Oregon Primary Care Association, the Oregon Health Leadership Council. There's a group, the Oregon Coalition for the Responsible Use of Medications, that has been having summits throughout the state related to this, as well as our academic partners, the schools of pharmacy, that's for OSU and OHSU and others. And I had mentioned the Coordinated Care Organizations and the Quality and Health Outcomes Committee. And a number of those committees have been also very interested, for example, the Hospital Metrics Committee, in at least hearing about what the issues of opiate overdose are. And so this is my last slide to just sort of say the kinds of things that within OHA we have done or are in the process of doing. Obviously, we're the people who have the prescription drug monitoring program and working with partners, and there's a committee that gives us input and advice about how to move forward with that. The CCOs have implemented a performance improvement project specific to opioids overdose, and we've provided a toolkit for them that's online. We have a website, and the primary purpose of our web, I bring that up really because people were looking for sort of a one-stop shopping, and it's primarily links to all of the different resources that are available throughout the state and at the federal level. We have a CDC grant that looks provides funding for some of the local health departments and the coordinated care partnerships with high levels of overdose. And then again, I had mentioned population-based data that we'll also be making available through our website. So with that, I'm happy to answer any additional questions you might have.
Are you aware of any legislation other than Representative Buehler's?
So, Chair Monis Anderson, I am aware of Senator Buehler's legislation and the Oregon Medical Association. They are also here and can speak more specifically to that. Obviously, we provide information as that moves ahead. But at this point, that's the only legislation that I am aware of for this short session.
Great. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We're about 10 minutes ahead of schedule, and so I don't think Multnomah County, they wanted to go first. I don't think the chair of Multnomah County is here yet. So, and I know that Dr. Bates wanted to talk about the Coordinated Care Organization.
The office is not answering the phone. So
okay.
You just want to start with the first one.
Okay. How about LC 38, repealing the sunset on the requirement that insurers reimburse licensed nurse practitioners and physician assistants? And I need to have a list here. Jen Baker, David Walls, and Courtney Dresser. And we'll have Jen Baker go first.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Jen Baker on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association and Nurse Practitioners of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony on in support of LC 38. During the 2013 legislation, the 2013 legislature passed House Bill 2902, which was intended to ensure payment parity for Oregon's nurse practitioners and physician assistants when providing primary or mental health services and billing under the same code as their physician colleagues. It's important to note that this bill did not change the scope of any practitioner or provider. Across Oregon, nurse practitioners and physician assistants are a critical part of our healthcare delivery system, and in certain parts of the state, nurse practitioners and PAs are the only primary care providers in town. This bill was in response to a trend that started in 2019 where some private insurance companies arbitrarily cut rates for nurse practitioners and PAs. And in some cases, especially with mental health and primary care, this reimbursement disparity based on the provider type and not on outcomes directly impacted providers' ability to provide care and limited patient access to care. making it difficult for providers to meet the primary care and mental health needs of their community. Oregon's payment parity law was the product of much discussion and compromise. After a multi-session effort, an agreement was reached that included amendments to address concerns that were raised throughout the process. Insurers were expressly prohibited from lowering physicians' reimbursement rates to ensure parity among providers. And we created a robust task force to look at primary care and mental health reimbursement that reported back to the legislature in both 2014 and 2015. The task force was asked to study and make recommendations for payment structures for reimbursement of insurers by licensed physicians, physician assistants, and certified nurse practitioners, and to find a way to promote the maintenance and expansion of primary care and mental health care workforce in Oregon and ensure all primary care and mental health practitioners are compensated fairly. Last month, the co-chairs of the task force sent out a letter to their colleagues serving with them, concluding that the duties of the task force had been fulfilled and they did not feel additional meetings were necessary, which is why we come to you here today. An informal audit done by DCBS conducted by DCBS found that current insurer practices in Oregon were in compliance, and that the insurers who were not reimbursing nurse practitioners and physician assistants at the level of parity to their physician colleagues were able to make that correction after the passage of 2902 with ease. And for those reasons, we're here today in support of LC 38 and ask you to remove the sunset on Oregon's payment parity law and ensure it stays in statute.
Good morning, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. My name is David Walls. I'm the Executive Director for the Osteopathic Physicians and Surgeons of Oregon. OPSO represents about 1,500 osteopathic physicians, residents, and medical students in the state of Oregon. And we oppose removing the sunset provisions on pay parity of House Bill 2902. Having a robust payment policy that supports a strong primary care network in Oregon is of a particular importance to osteopathic physicians. DOs, the majority of DOs serve in primary care fields. Unfortunately, the number of DOs choosing to go into primary care has been decreasing over the last several years. Nationally and currently, 56% of DOs are in primary care. In 2014, that number was 60%. So we saw a 4% drop of DOs in primary care in the last year. And as students graduate from medical school and they're looking into their residency program where they choose their specialty, there's a disincentive to go into primary care as it's the lowest reimbursed of the specialties, and of course we're seeing higher and higher costs. So adequate reimbursement in primary care is essential for all providers, and that's why we're really pleased that HB 2902 created that task force to take a comprehensive look at payment policies and recommend that structure, a payment structure for all providers. Unfortunately, we didn't see a comprehensive payment policy come out of that work group. I know the complexity of the task is very high, but we do believe that a payment methodology can be made that doesn't tie the reimbursement rates between three different provider types. They have different educational requirements, they have different credentialing requirements, different insurance requirements, different certification requirements. Looking at the impetus for 2902, it wasn't... The issue came up that insurers were dropping the reimbursement rates of nurse practitioners arbitrarily. The issue with HB 2902, it didn't come out because nurse practitioners weren't getting paid the same as physicians or physician assistants weren't getting paid the same as nurse practitioners. It was because insurers were dropping these rates and they needed to be restored, and adequate reimbursement was obviously necessary for nurse practitioners. So the payment policy in 2902 that ties nurse practitioner and physician payment rates to physician rates wasn't a solution to these bad actions from insurers, but it was a temporary policy why this task force can create a permanent payment policy. So if we remove the sunset now, I really feel we give up on the opportunity to address current payment reforms that adequately reimburse all providers. The language in 2902 allows us through the full next session, so we have all of next session to enact policies that address reform in primary care. So I urge the committee to oppose the removal of the sunset and really pursue the development of payment structures that expand the network of primary care providers in Oregon and value the training and expertise of all providers. Thank you.
Good morning and Happy New Year. Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association. I think, you know, my colleagues here have discussed this concept and the bill very well and the history of why we were all here in 2013. All of you were with us in quite a long debate and discussion and a lot of amendments. I think we had a dash 25 at some point. So it was a long process to get us to 2902. And with that, I think there's still discussion to be had. The task force did what it could. I think it kind of sputtered a little bit with a lot of different things that were happening that were not in their control. But there are discussions happening on payer reform, multi-payer reform within the Oregon Health Policy Board. We should continue those discussions before we eliminate this sunset and lift this sunset. So at this point, that's where we are at OMA. We would like to continue those discussions. Our fear is if we remove the sunset prematurely, then we kind of lose that drive to get people to that table to have those discussions. So that's what we're hoping we can continue to do. And with that, with keeping everything as is, it doesn't hurt MPs now, it doesn't hurt providers, it doesn't hurt patients. Thank you.
And the sunset date is?
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, this is scheduled to sunset in January 2018.
Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
If I may, in the past, I had significant concerns about this bill, and I appreciate the work that was done in the 2013 session to address a lot of those concerns. I'm going to be neutral on this one. I'll vote for it if it comes to the floor. I don't have a strong opinion one way or another. But I would say in response to what Mr. Walls and Ms. Dresser have said, that you will remember that there was Senate Bill 231 in the 2015 session, which largely focused on exactly the issue, Mr. Walls, that you brought up, bringing together under the auspices of the health authority commercial insurers and CCOs to talk about alternative payment methodologies primarily for primary care to support the additional services. My objection to this bill in the past has not been because I want to diminish the merit of the nurse practitioners in our community who are providing important services, but rather because, as you have stated, fee-for-service is a really crummy way to pay for health care, and we need to move to robust alternative payment methodologies. Ms. Baker, I'd be very interested if you had a number of whether DCBS could have provide us with a number of how many people had their payments changed as a result of the bill. Because frankly, if we're talking about a handful, which was kind of my understanding when we were dealing with this in 2013, I don't want to make a tempest in a teapot about this. And I do hope that the work group that's going on through the health authority, and maybe there's somebody who can comment on that at some point when we hear this bill for real, is going to make significant movement on the issue of alternative payment methodologies.
All right. I'm always someone who wants to make sure that there's equal pay for equal work, and that is the crux of why I have always strongly supported this this bill. But do any of the insurers want to talk at all and give an opinion? No. Okay. With that, thank you very much. We will continue with discussion on our legislative concepts. And I think Mr. Mayor, later? Okay. All right. So go ahead and have at least Multnomah County talk.
Okay.
Yes. No, Bates is not here yet. Okay.
So it's your call.
Yes, and I know that Multnomah County is here, and I don't want to keep the chair, Kafori, here any longer. So I'll briefly open up LC5 and hear your testimony on that, and then we will go back to the others, because I do plan to end with LC5. So I will open an informational on LC5 and call up Chair Deborah Kafori from Multnomah County. And I want to preface this with Multnomah County has been instrumental in trying to come up with a draft, and we still have some changes that we want to make. And thank you, Claudia Black, with conveying your views to Mark Mayer, our legislative counsel, who's working on this bill, because the form that you see now is not going to be the actual bill being introduced. We're going to hear what people have to say today, and then I've worked with legislative counsel, and they will be giving a final draft to us. Drop-dead date is Tuesday, next Tuesday, so legislative counsel has said that we'll be able to make those changes. Okay.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman O'Sullivan.
Oh, do you want to explain the bill?
No,
she can do it.
Yeah.
When you have Mark.
Go for it.
My name is Deborah Kafori. I'm the chairwoman of Multnomah County. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of a statewide tobacco retail licensing program. Our state needs a robust licensing system to cut the supply of cigarettes and nicotine products to youth, to ensure that retailers have a level playing field, and to enforce existing laws. As you probably have heard many, many times, Multnomah County has a rate of illegal sales of tobacco to minors that is three times higher than the rest of the nation. Last November, the Board of Multnomah County Commissioners enacted a local licensing ordinance to reduce youth access. We're about to begin rulemaking for that program, and I think it should be noted that we had little to no opposition to our ordinance. There are many people and many businesses who strongly support our plan and believe it is past time to take action on this issue. During the hearings for our ordinance, we heard from students who told us how easy it was to find a retailer willing to sell them cigarettes without checking for their identification. For licensing systems to be effective, they must include outreach and education, as well as a robust inspection program and significant fines or license suspensions for violations. When done effectively, tobacco licensing can dramatically reduce illegal sales to minors. In terms, specifically to the legislative concept that you've prepared, we support your legislation because we believe that every child in the state should be protected from illegal sales of nicotine products. However, we do believe that a few changes could strengthen the draft that we've seen to date. One is we recommend removing the fee amount from the statute and adding language that allows the fees to be established by administrative rule to reflect the true cost of licensing administration, outreach, education, inspections, and enforcement. Insufficient fees could create a weak enforcement program or create the need to use general funds to augment the program. Two, for a tobacco retail licensing program to be successful, we believe it is essential to establish partnerships with the business and retailer community. Multnomah County has a lot of experience working with businesses as part of our inspection program for restaurants and food carts. And we've learned that outreach and education are vital tools to protect public health. In particular, smaller businesses need our help to understand the requirements of the laws that we pass. And we support adding language that allows the state to enter into agreements to fund local communities to conduct outreach and education in addition to inspection and enforcement. We believe that with these changes, the state can create a licensing program that will greatly reduce youth access to nicotine products. Thank you for your work, and thank you for allowing me this opportunity today.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And we're happy to continue to work with you.
And yes, because we'll need to, I want to have a final draft, hopefully by Saturday or Sunday, so I can.
We can do it.
Yes, we can do it. All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, we will go back to, thank you, Multnomah County, and we will now go to LC-153, which is the physical therapy licensure compact. James Heider and Jeremy Hilliard.
Chair Mona Sanderson, committee members, my name is James Heider. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Physical Therapist Licensing Board. And I'm here today to answer any questions you might have about the compact. We talked in November a little bit at legislative days then. But what I want to reiterate is that the PT Licensing Board, their primary accountability is protection of the public. And we do that through credentialing of initial licensure, through ongoing professional development, and one of the things the board strongly believes is that part of the protection of the public includes the access to care, to make sure that all our citizens of Oregon have access to proper care for physical therapy. The compact itself is a mechanism by which we can break down barriers to licensure between states. It's an interstate contract. And once you become part of the compact, if, as an example, Washington were part of the compact and Oregon were part of the compact, someone who was duly licensed in Washington, had a clean record, had been credentialed by the state of Washington, could come and work in Oregon with their Washington license, true reciprocity, and vice versa. The Oregon Board has been instrumental nationally over the past several years in breaking down barriers to licensure. We've done this through acceptance of uniform exam scores for licensees coming to us from other states. We've done it by developing streamlined processes for foreign educated therapists, by which we've reduced the licensure process for qualified foreign educated therapists from months to be licensed to weeks to be licensed in Oregon, and we were the first state to do that, and other states are using that model now. We see the compact as another opportunity to break down the barriers, to allow for access to care for our citizens of Oregon, especially in our remote areas, in our border towns. The board would ask that, let you know that we support this, and we will be here to answer any questions and to help move this bill forward. Thank you for your time.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to come and testify in support of legislative concept 153. My name is Jeremy Hilliard. I am a physical therapist and academic coordinator of clinical education for Pacific University, where I oversee the placement of 150 students per year at various locations throughout Oregon and the United States. I'm here today speaking on behalf of the Oregon Physical Therapy Association, which represents over 1,300 physical therapist assistants, and students within the state of Oregon. We are in support of legislative concept 153 because it does increase public access to physical therapy, and it does help with reducing the barriers to licensure in multiple states. As a practitioner who was previously dually licensed in the state of Oregon and the state of Washington, now solely in Oregon, I can speak firsthand to the difficulty of becoming licensed in another state. And without any negative marks on my record, it took a number of months to obtain my license, which was a burden on my employer as well as me when I was going to be treating up there. So it increases that portability of licensure without placing the public at increased risk, as Mr. Heider could speak much more profoundly on than me. But we are certainly in support of this. So,
thank you. Any comments? It is a very good bill. I look at nurses, and I received my license in the state of Virginia, and when I moved back to Oregon, no problems in getting, there's reciprocity there. I wish we could have it with physicians also, but I see too many heads shaking, but that is, and let's start with physical therapists and see where we can go from here on out with other professions.
Just to be clear, I absolutely support multi-state compacts for physician licensures.
Oh, great.
Absolutely support it. I'd love to see it for pretty much all of our professions because it would only be a boon to the state.
Even with dentists, because we have these volunteer dentists coming in, and it's we had to pass legislation to make sure, but we limited their practice to only a couple of weeks, I think. And with physicians, we have the same issue, especially with our nonprofits. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There is no opposition out there. If there's any opposition, we're going to maybe move this the very first time we can get it. So if there's anyone who doesn't want to know about, see this going through, now is the time to voice your concerns. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Bates is here to talk about coordinated care organization tweaks on LC 36.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
And we do not have a draft, correct?
Sort of correct. It came out late last night. I haven't had any chance to even look at it. So I'm holding that back a little bit until I have a chance at least to read it. So let me kind of tell you what we're trying to do, Madam Chair. For the record, Alan Bates, State Senator from District 3. As we all know, in the last year and a half, we've had something which I will call growing pains in CCO land. We've all been a part of that. I got a lot of phone calls from CCOs across the state, and even went out to Eastern Oregon and visited one in Baker City and around the state. And what we finally decided to do was ask the CCOs amongst themselves to come together with what they consider concepts that they all could agree to. They have a consensus on it. Before you have, we have the five major concepts that they want to deal with in this session, and they have a consensus around that. And then we didn't get that back until early December, so we couldn't get it drafted in time to have a full draft given to you. The plan is that we will look at the draft next Thursday, not this Thursday, next Thursday here at the Capitol from 10 to 3. Any senators, representatives that want to attend that meeting are invited. The CCOs have the representatives there. OHA already knows about this. They'll have their representatives there. We want to go through the bill, see if we've really gotten where we need to get to. The bill will include, besides these issues, a discussion of more transparency inside CCOs. It's not aimed at any particular CCO, but I have concerns about where the flexible money is going, how we're spending that, what's really being done with it. I'm also concerned that when outside entities come in and buy a CCO, where that money is going and how that money is being spent. This is taxpayer money, either local, state, or federal, and it's not designed to make millionaires out of people. It's designed to be reinvested in those communities to make it a healthier community, and I have concerns about that. So there'll be language we're trying to get to that would offer us an opportunity to be a little more careful about where that money goes inside CCOs. I think some CCOs would think it's a shot at them. It's not. It's about true transparency. We want to track the money. We want to make sure it's being used properly, and that's helping people in our state. So those are the very broad parts of this bill. It's not going to change a lot of things, but I'm hoping it'll sort of tap down the rhetoric we've been hearing and make it a smoother situation for rate setting, what a global budget is, how we go about getting our next waiver with CMS, and all the issues that are involved with that. And that's basically what it is. So I've called it a reconciliation bill. This is not groundbreaking, but it's something we got to get done so we have a better picture of what's happening in CCO land.
Could you, for the record, just read through the concepts just to get it on the record orally? I know we have the written copy.
These are the five concepts that CCOs came together and agreed on, and they all have agreed to this, all 16 of them. Concept one, require OHA to issue a determination on 99% of all applications or renewals within 30 days of submission. Develop metrics for OHA to meet on wait time and number of drop calls for the member facing OHP phone lines. Concept two, require quality incentive measure specs and baselines for new specs be released before the end of the first quarter of the measurement year, and ideally before the end of the previous calendar, and or OHA shall submit quality bonus requirements to the CCOs by October 1st for the coming year. Concept three, additional benefits for members must be added in the beginning of a contract year and be included in the rates for that year. There's a 1% rule right now that is open to discussion. You know, let me explain this so it kind of makes you understand why the other concepts are important. If you put in a new benefit, it's a half a percentage point, you get it in. But you can get 10 or 15 of those together, and all of a sudden the costs have gone way up. So we want to clarify that rule, okay? Concept four, direct OHA to open up enrollment for new rulemaking to strengthen foster care and opt-out provisions. Concept five, OHA must create uniform reporting for all CCOs so rates and data can be compared equitably. And there was an honorable mention, which has already been fixed. Okay, but I left it there because you might get a kick out of it. Representative Hayden was concerned, and rightfully so, about some surface area change rules. That has actually already been resolved. That issue is not going to be in the bill.
Okay. Where is your meeting next Thursday?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's in the conference room in LC.
Okay. And as you know, I heard that the House is going to have some parts of this in another bill, or?
My understanding, the House bill is a little different, and there's not any. Okay. I've talked to Representative Greenlee, and I don't think we're overlapping each other. We'll be looking at it as. And this bill will probably travel down to Ways and Means, because obviously there's going to be a physical on this one.
Yes. And the fact that we only have four meetings that we meet, and two of them will have already happened before your reconciliation meeting on Thursday, and that'll leave us just 2 days. Oh, wait, no, next Thursday, January.
No, we're doing this prior to session, so if it goes well, we'll bring this bill to you as a consensus bill. If it does not go well, we may not bring you the bill.
Oh, okay.
Okay. We haven't got time to, and obviously we don't have time to battle it out over a bill here. We've got to get this together as a consensus bill. Everyone agrees to, understands, and gets out.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
So thank you, and for giving us a heads up, and hopefully the stakeholders that are in the room will be looking for LC36. Let's jump to. We'll close the information on LC36 and open an information on LC155. And Josh Free, Kevin Russell, and Nikki Terzia.
Good morning, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Nikki Terzieff, and here on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Coalition, we represent the Main Street pharmacists and the pharmacists who work within the health systems and the hospital systems. I'm here today with Josh Free and
Kevin Russell.
Kevin Russell, thank you. And we're here to talk about LC-155. LC-155 is a follow-up bill to one that was passed in 2013, HB 2123. 2123 set into statute some policy changes that were going to help pharmacists help serve their patients and be a part of the healthcare providing system with cost effectiveness and convenience, and negotiate a little bit better with their partners, PBMs, pharmacy benefit management companies. The bill has now been in effect for a couple of, all of the bill has been in effect now for about a year. And as we've seen the implementation of the bill, there's still some little housekeeping pieces, some concerns, and some, frankly, infractions that are still occurring. And so we are looking at LC-155 as a way to work with the insurance division to bolster the enforcement mechanism and also to do a little bit of clarity in statute around what 2123 really fully meant. There is a small PowerPoint presentation, thank you, to help describe and illustrate some of the issues that the pharmacists are facing. And with that, I will turn it over to them.
Chairman Monis Anderson and members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to testify here. My name is Josh Free. I'm a pharmacist, president of Oregon State Pharmacy Association, and general manager for a long-term care pharmacy based out of Portland. And so this issue affects us pretty directly in terms of the reimbursements that we receive from PBMs and some of the issues surrounding how payments work in pharmacy. And so I have a little bit of data I can share with you. And just briefly, the source of this data, it's aggregated data from over 20 million transactions among long-term care pharmacies. First slide here just shows if you're a pharmacy, and whether it's long-term care pharmacy or any other pharmacy that contracts with a PBM, this is sort of what the picture looks like over the last 3 years. The top line shows revenue per prescription coming into the pharmacy, and you see that that's relatively flat over 3 years. The middle line shows total cost to dispense those prescriptions, which is climbing pretty significantly over the time frame. And so obviously the margin is decreasing. And so someone is capturing that margin, and it's not the providers that are getting drugs to our patients. So that's one of the issues that we face. As far as reimbursement using a MAC model, part of 2123 that is now in statute, as you see here, said that the PBMs must provide us a list of drugs reimbursed using a MAC pricing model every 7 days. And what we're seeing is, just as one example, this is MAC variability for just one drug, polyethylene glycol. From the top five Medicare, top five PBMs adjudicating claims for Medicare Part D programs. And so what you see is that although the list should be updated every 7 days, we're seeing MAC pricing adjusted on an almost daily basis. And so the kind of wild lines going up and down all over the graph here just show that the reimbursement to the pharmacy is changing almost every day amongst the top PBMs, which makes it very difficult as a pharmacy to know from on a day-to-day basis what you'll be reimbursed for a drug, and often that reimbursement is below your actual cost. A couple other things I can speak to, parts of House Bill 2123 that are now enacted that we don't seem to be getting the desired effect. There's a process to appeal your reimbursement, and a couple specific things required there of the PBM, such as providing a telephone number and an individual who is responsible for processing appeals, and we just don't see that happening. So quite a bit of difficulty in actually getting a hold of anyone with a PBM to appeal the rate that we're being reimbursed. Also, if an appeal is denied, getting an NDC code of a specific drug that we're supposed to use, that's been quite difficult, and not always able to actually access those drugs that we're supposedly able to obtain at a specific cost that's driving the MAC reimbursement model. So and that model of driving towards a specific NDC, it doesn't really reflect the way pharmacies purchase drugs. So we don't all have complete open access to every drug that's on the market. They're not always available in our area. Like a specific generic drug or a specific manufacturer of a generic drug might not be available within my buying organization, for example. So, and then the other part of the bill that I'd like to speak to has to do with auditing practices. And so I think everyone agrees that fair audits are an important part of what should be happening here. You know, trying to help avoid fraud, waste, and abuse within the system, and auditing is certainly part of that. What we see, though, is a lot of auditing based on clerical errors that don't result in any financial harm to the PBM. And so we still see, even though the recouping costs associated with clerical errors is not allowed under House Bill 2123, we still see a lot of audits targeting those sorts of things and having to fight off audits based on things that don't result in any change to whether that drug should have been prescribed and paid for. And so that's one of the challenges that we face in pharmacy. So,
Madam Chair,
yes.
I just have a question about that. Give me a sense of the magnitude of that issue. How often do clerical errors occur that result in the kinds of fines that you're talking about? What percentage of the number of prescriptions written statewide by any pharmacist? Do you have a sense? Mm-hmm.
That's a great question. I don't know that I could answer that with any authority to say exactly like on a percentage basis. But I will say that my pharmacy processes prescriptions for around 7,000 patients, and I have a full-time staff member devoted to audits. So if that puts it in perspective for you at all, it's someone that her primary duty is to research and provide paperwork and follow up and sort of defend us against recoupment of reimbursement for drugs that we may have already dispensed, you know, anywhere from 2 to 10 years ago. And so going back and retrieving these records and proving that that we had a valid prescription and all those sorts of things is a pretty significant time drain.
Just, if I may, Madam Chair, so does I apologize, I have not read the entire LC in detail yet, but does it include a statute of limitations for audits? Because frankly, I mean, even the IRS doesn't require you keep records more than 7 years. So I guess I'm surprised when I empathize. I mean, physicians deal with this all the time, right? We have people who just do insurances or just do prior authorizations or whatever if your practice is big enough. But
2123 had a limitation. I believe it was 24 months. However, there's a little bit of variability there because for drugs reimbursed under Medicare Part D, Medicare allows audits that go back up to 10 years. So we will face that regardless of what we do here in Oregon. And I don't think anyone objects to the two-year component. In my specific practice site, because of the seniors that I serve that are often on Medicare Part D, we see audits that go back farther than that. Let's see. So with that, I'll turn it over to Kevin.
Hi. I'm Kevin Russell. I am a president-elect for Oregon State Pharmacy Association, and my current position is I'm a division pharmacy manager for Albertsons Safeway, although I'm not representing them today. I was also an independent pharmacy owner for a long time, and the speaking from where I was back then, that there was, of course, shrinking margins that were pushing independent pharmacies out of business, but there was also a component of below-cost reimbursements that was going on. And I was, when I had my independent pharmacy, I was spending a full day extra a week while I employed another pharmacist just so I could follow up on reimbursement claims that I was or wasn't getting reimbursed appropriately on. And that was quite the burden. And eventually the shrinking margins and the burden that was ever increasing of having to fight for reimbursement claims is what pushed me to get out of independent pharmacy. But even looking back at that, I consider that almost the golden age where I was, because then at least I could get a hold of someone and try to adjust my claims. Now independent pharmacies are telling us that they can't even get a hold of anyone that has a decision-making authority to even adjust a claim. Or, you know, they're being denied, even though the statute, the new regulations say they shouldn't be denied. And they just don't have any recourse on that. You know, currently in a chain environment, we're currently getting thousands of below-cost claims that are coming in. And we just can't chase them all down. There's just no way to do that, particularly when we do go after claims and they only adjust that single claim versus applying it to all the claims for that particular drug that have been transacted over that appropriate period of time. So that's been a significant issue, and there's no way that we can employ people to audit all those claims. And some of this can affect patient care, and I'll explain it. I had a good example that just popped up last night for me, where a pharmacist called me from one of my stores and said that a patient presented a prescription for a heart failure medication, and the cost to the pharmacy was $73 for the prescription. The total reimbursement through the PBM was $13. So it would have been a $60 loss on that prescription if they were going to fill it. And our policy is that we generally fill everything regardless of reimbursement, but they said this is a huge loss. Well, you know, if we continue this every month, I mean, what do I do? And I said, well, we fill the prescription, but we just hope that our MAC will adjust next month. So maybe we won't lose money next month, or maybe we'll be able to purchase the drug cheaper next time we purchase it, and we won't lose money. But that's just a single example of something that happens. And I look at this and go, well, what if this person went to a different pharmacy and someone said, I'm sorry, you know, we can't sell you this medicine through your insurance because they're only paying us $13, right? And then they end up going home without their heart failure medication. You know, so, I mean, these things can actually directly affect the patients as well. You know, and so really what we're needing is, number one, we need the contact at the PBMs that we can, that are decision makers, that we can actually get an adjustment made. And we're also needing that adjustment applied to all transactions from the earliest date the claim is identified as being need to be adjusted. And it needs to be applied to all pharmacies in the network, because the you know, we can't go after these one at a time if there's an incorrect minimum cost for that is out there, then we need to, that needs to be applied to everyone because it's affecting everyone if there's an incorrect cost in reimbursement in place. And finally, you know, we need enforcement. There needs to be some risk of loss of licensure or substantial fines that compels compliance with this, because what we're seeing right now is, you know, we mentioned that this is the law now and we need to do this, and they still are not, you know, adjusting the claims. And so there just hasn't been any enforcement that's gone on this year on that. So
we have the numbers of I think I've had some emails, but the numbers of readjustment claims that have not been resolved, that how many that you have. I mean, it'd be nice to know what the playing field is here.
Chair Monis Anderson, Representative Rob Nose has been trying to help us kind of get our arms around what that information looks like. I believe that he's been working with the insurance division. I don't want to speak for him, but we'll be certainly looking after that information so we can help to inform the conversation.
Thank you. Other questions? All right. Thank you very much. Let's call Tom Holt and Jonathan Eames up.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions. We have a pharmacy benefit management program called Omeda RX within our company. We were part of the work group that developed 2123 over, I think it was probably about a year-long process almost. It was a long one in any event. And many of the issues you just heard about were hashed out very thoroughly in that work group and dealt with in the legislation. Respectfully, the LC draft, as we read it, and we appreciate that Bill Cross provided it to us Monday afternoon when he had received it, so we'd had a chance to review ahead of today, at least initially. It does a lot more than housekeeping. It makes some substantial changes to how what's referred to as MAC pricing, that's maximum allowable cost pricing, is handled in pharmacy claims. At a high level, pharmacies get, the way the MAC system works out is that pharmacies sometimes get reimbursed well above cost, and sometimes it is below cost. But on average, our goal is for our pharmacies to be fairly reimbursed, have a fair profit margin on generics. It is a very dynamic space. We've seen some headline cases in recent months of people in the mergers and acquisitions business going and buying up a product and increasing the cost 5,000%. That kind of stuff happens in this space, and it's a very difficult space for everyone to manage the cost. I think, you know, it's also important to draw a distinction, as I appreciate one of the prior witnesses did, between what happens in the Medicare world and what happens in the rest of the market. We cannot control Medicare's rules at a state level. If pharmacies are being audited beyond 2 years back on Medicare claims, that's because Medicare is requiring that it be done. And we have no control over that. We certainly try to treat our pharmacies fairly. But I think the bottom line here is that this is an issue fraught with complexity. We can't support the bill in its current form. We would be happy to be supportive of the, those few things that are, that appear to be purely technical in this coming session, but these issues around who gets reimbursed for a claims adjustment and when were litigated in 2013 with that bill, and we think we have good language in the statute now. We'd be happy to be part of a broader stakeholder group that actually has time to dig into what's really happening now in terms of enforcement. To our knowledge, our company hasn't had any issues so far with this. Of course, we had an appeals process before there was a bill in 2013. So with that, we're opposed to the bill as it now stands. If we could peel out the substantial policy changes, we could find our way to support some technical changes in this session.
Great. Thanks. Jonathan.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Eames, and I'm here on behalf of CVS Health, which is a pharmacy benefits manager, as well as they operate a number of pharmacies around the country, not many in this state, but actually that's going to change because they now are going to be moving into the Target stores, the ones that Targets that have pharmacies. And so we're going to see. I get to add some more things to my plate as far as issues to be looking after at the legislature. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about LC 155. I'll try not to duplicate a lot of what Mr. Holt has said, but it is true, a little bit of history. I sat on the work group for the PBM work group. So basically in 2012, there was a bill that was proposed that made significant changes to how we operate in our business that was not passed, and so we developed a work group, and we met nearly monthly for, you know, 8 months to a year to get to a place at the 2013 legislative session where very contentious but productive conversation ensued about changes that should be made to the statute. Now, those changes included the way we conducted our audits, which audits are there to detect fraud and abuse, the way that they required PBMs to register with the DCBS so that there was a record of them. And it did require a phone number for them to be contacted in the case that they had disputes or questions with the PBM, made changes to the maximum allowable cost, which we've talked about here today already. And it changed the appeals for reimbursement and other provisions. So a number of provisions. And let me tell you, because I was the one who testified near the end of session, at the end, we came up and testified neutral. So what that shows you is that a process which took months and months and months to develop very contentious, complicated issues didn't result in some huge, massive fight where you have to throw a bill in front of the legislature and make them decide it. It resulted in a productive conversation. We weren't happy with all the provisions, I'll be honest, but we did testify neutral, and we've been implementing those changes, the last of which was in the beginning of 2015. So we've got a full bill for about a year. And when I heard the testimony last legislative days in November, you know, the representative came here and discussed what they wanted to do, which is to enforce the previous bill better or make sure that people were following the law. PBMs were following the law, and pharmacists were following the law. So we thought, well, that's appropriate. Everybody should be following the law, and that's something we should definitely make sure is happening. And if it's not happening, we absolutely have to have that conversation about how to better enforce the law that's on the books. We've been meeting with the Department of Insurance, CVS has, as well as a number of other insurers have been meeting with the Department of Insurance over the last few months frequently. They have a lot of questions about how this is. You know, it's a new area for the DCBS. So they have been asking us questions. There were a number of complaints that were filed with DCBS, and so we've been trying to address them. I think what's important when we have this discussion is to determine the number of substantiated complaints, you know, the ones that actually did result in or have been affirmed that there has been some practices that are not working. But we want to have that conversation. That's something we want to do. We want to follow the law. That's just what we should do. The changes in this LC go far beyond that kind of change. There's really significant, huge impacts in the way that we would do our business and do reimbursement if these changes were implemented in the bill. And we would have serious concerns. We are opposed to the bill as it stands, but we would have serious concerns if those were to move forward, because those are huge changes in the reimbursement. So I just want to say, keep in mind, it took months and months to develop what came to our neutrality on the bill in 2013. We're not opposed to any conversation. We're happy to have that conversation. But in what would be about seven business days to pass this bill and this legislative session out of this committee is just not nearly enough time to deal and tackle with these difficult issues.
Well, I'm most interested in making sure that House Bill 2123 is being enforced.
Absolutely.
And there may be some bad players. So at our next public hearing, we will have to have the insurance division come and present their findings because I don't want to lose our local pharmacies. And they are going by the wayside. They are. And that can really hurt access for many people. Not everybody can go to a Target. Not everybody can go to, well, anyway, we need as much access as possible. So it's extremely important for the players to meet and see if we can get some changes before our public hearing in February. It is extremely important because I do feel that some of these concerns are valid, and especially with some of the information I've gotten from the insurance division. So that's where I am here. Anyone else?
I look forward to hearing more testimony on this issue, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to call up, we'll do LC 134, informational on LC 134, and is Adam Kirscher and Marcus Watt.
Good morning, Chair Monis Anderson and committee members. My name is Marcus Watt. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. And I want to say that the Board of Pharmacy fully supports the goal of LC 134, which is to increase access of safe and effective previously dispensed and donated prescription drugs to the benefit of our low-income and indigent populations. On seeing this concept, board staff looked at this and we had some suggestions that we felt would make this would still meet the goal, increase the access, and still address some concerns that we might have as far as guaranteeing the safety and efficacy of the drugs. And as such, we had a conference call yesterday with Senator Gelser's staff and the proponents of the bill and came up with some suggestions that we all agree with that we will be submitting tomorrow to address those concerns. And so I believe at this point in time we're fully on the same page in supporting the concept.
Thank you very much.
And so thank you, Chairwoman and members. So I'm co-founder and director of Serum. We're a 501c3.
Your name, please.
Oh, Adam Kirscher. And so I'm co-founder and director of Serum, a 501c3 nonprofit based at Stanford University. And Serum's aim is to make sure that no person skips their medications due to cost. But unfortunately, one in four people currently do. We do this by helping long-term care pharmacies donate their surplus medicine and then repackage that and send that out to charitable pharmacies under a depot model that helps uninsured and underinsured people get the medications that they need. The medications are all unopened, unexpired, no controlled substances at all. Serum actually operates in four states. We've helped about 85,000 people get the medications that they need, about $5 million worth of medicine. And this type of law is actually in 40 states. So what you've seen is actually what we've pulled language from some laws in Colorado and Missouri that have allowed this type of repackaging to be done. And we've worked closely with the board in the past, and we just had a recent conference call, and I think we're very aligned on the changes that need to happen. So we look forward to those amendments and hope that you'll support the bill.
Thank you very much. Any comments?
And I'm not sure if this bill will come to this committee. Since it deals with prescription drugs, I thought that maybe it would, or it would go to Sarah Gelser's Human Services.
Up here,
yeah.
Chair.
I agree it should come here, but we'll see what the president wants to do. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Okay. With that, I'd like to go back to LC5, our tobacco licensure. And Mark Mayer, I would love to have come in. Basically, we really need to have a licensure in the state of Oregon. And I'd like Mark, who's been working on this, and we'll have a final draft soon, go through the bill and as maybe potential changes that we have already talked about that we're going to make, you could cite that too.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Mark Mayer, Deputy Legislative Counsel, here to testify briefly about LC5, which requires tobacco and electronic cigarette retailers to be licensed in this state. I don't have a lot of time, so I'll just speak broadly about the provisions of the bill and try to draw people's attention to what the bill does broadly. The bill basically requires the Department of Revenue to license retailers of both electronic cigarettes and other types of inhalant delivery systems, as well as sellers of tobacco products. That is the basic component of the bill. The bill also requires enforcement of laws of this state, as well as local ordinances and federal laws by two state agencies with respect to their respective areas of expertise. Where the Department of Revenue is concerned, they're going to be looking at whether or not there's a violation of the tax laws. And that concerns wholesalers are currently licensed, but distributors and receivers of distributed product, there are also provisions that apply to them. So it's going to give them some ability to enforce those laws at the point of sale. Oregon Health Authority in the bill still is primarily responsible for enforcing public health and safety law. The bill requires them to enter into an interagency agreement whereby they share information related to what they're doing with respect to enforcement. If the Oregon Health Authority conducts an administrative hearing and they impose a civil penalty for a violation, the bill requires them to send that information over to Department of Revenue so Department of Revenue can decide whether or not to instigate a proceeding involving the license and whether the license should be suspended or revoked. So that's basically how the bill works in a nuts and bolts type fashion. Some of the particular, and real quickly, I should say that this is a product that was worked on between our office, Department of Revenue, and the Oregon Health Authority. It doesn't incorporate some of the other interested parties' comments yet.
Now, would you call this a dual licensure?
No, it is not a dual licensure. Okay. Department of Revenue runs the licensure scheme. Oregon Health Authority continues to administer public health and safety law. But then they share information with Department of Revenue, so Department of Revenue can have that for purposes of looking at whether or not the license should be suspended or revoked.
And then the fee from the license, then how is that distributed? Because OHA will need to have fees for enforcement.
Correct.
I don't know if DOR needs.
So currently the bill requires a $300 fee with an escalation clause. If OHA or DOR finds that they are spending, I believe the figure is 20% more in enforcing or administering their respective programs than they are getting from the fee money, then they can appeal to the legislature for a bump up fee increase in order to cover those costs. So there is an escalation clause, but it is set semi-permanently in statute at $300. What the bill does is it requires DOR to share fee monies with the Oregon Health Authority, although no other monies that they may be collecting under the program. For instance, civil penalty monies that DOR collects will stay with DOR. The fee monies, though, will be shared between the two agencies for the enforcement.
Right. And that is some of the input for those in the audience, the stakeholders, is something that we're looking at changing and not having a set fee and put that in rule rather than in statute.
Yeah, correct. So that's really the nuts and bolts of it. This bill is really mainly about interagency cooperation and interagency, you know, general authority to issue licenses and enforce laws that already exist. There are not a lot of substantial laws written into this bill. A licensed premises may not be located in a residential zone, so that's one thing that's spelled out that is of substance other than the mechanics of how the licensing program will work. I think that there is one other condition. Yeah, on page 3, a licensed premises must be fixed and permanent. We work with that language with DOR, and that's to prevent mobile premises or other premises, for instance, like a food cart type situation where it can be it is movable type premises. So it is supposed to be a structure, a building, a fixed and permanent place of business. So those are the two requirements that are imposed. It doesn't address some of the other requirements that were in previous versions of this bill from last session. Whether or not it can be sold in a, whether or not a pharmacy can sell, or whether or not cigarettes or electronic cigarettes, or how close to a school or things like that. I do want to draw attention to the preemption clause because I know that's of great interest to a lot of people. It's on page 7 of the current LC. And basically what the preemption clause does is it says that only the state can administer a licensing program, so there'll be no dual licensure at a state and local level. And then it preempts counties and cities and other local governments, just cities and counties, excuse me, from imposing, I'll just read it, a city or county may not adopt an ordinance that conditions the type of premises that may make retail sales of tobacco products or inhalant delivery systems, or that conditions where a premises may be located to make retail sales of tobacco products or inhalant delivery systems, except as authorized by or pursuant to the statutory laws of the state. That's pretty general language. What that does preempt is type of premises, what type of store it is. So that would preempt a city or county from saying no store that has a pharmacy within it or no pharmacy can sell these types of products. And then where would preempt a retail location from not being located within 1,000 feet of a school. What it doesn't address, which was in some previous versions from last session, is what type of products may be regulated and how our city or county may regulate types of products and how types of products are sold. That is untouched by the preemption language.
So that the local cities and counties can do whatever they want.
With regard to
type of product
or how the product is sold, correct. Okay. That it leaves that open for local control.
Excellent. Thanks, Mark. You've been great. We even had a conversation while I was in the airport and Chicago waiting to fly home, and we were working on this bill. So thank you very much for the time that you've put into this.
Yeah, thank you, members of the committee.
Okay. With that, let's start with Sarah Higginson, Morgan Cowling.
Thank you. My name is Sarah Higginbotham. I'm here representing the American Heart Association and the American Stroke Association. Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson and committee members, for the opportunity to address a very important issue to the health of Oregonians today. I want to thank a number of folks on the committee, including the chair and Senator Steiner Hayward, for their continued work on tobacco control. Tobacco remains the number one preventable cause of death in our state, killing 7,000 Oregonians every year and costing our state $3 billion in lost productivity and health-related costs. Just a quick reminder that 68,000 children today are alive that will die prematurely from tobacco-related causes if we don't do anything. As you already heard from Chair Kafori in Multnomah County, the state of Oregon is far behind the rest of the country when it comes to tobacco retail licensure. So, again, my thanks to your work on this. The American Heart Association does support a statewide tobacco retail licensure system. However, we have some concerns in the current bill draft that it's I'm unsure yet if the chair is planning on addressing those or not, but that we wanted to highlight. The American Heart Association cannot support the preemptions outlined in Section 13 of the bill. We would be concerned that limiting local jurisdictions from the ability to tailor local policies critical to the advancement of tobacco control on the ground would be detrimental to the tobacco control movement in this state and to the ability of local jurisdictions to protect kids. So those two preemptions that Mark Mayer mentioned, zoning around schools as well as the type of retailer, would be of great concern to the American Heart Association. Secondly, we would like to see the bill include and highlight support for training and education, specifically culturally specific training education for retailers, and making sure that it's clarified that local jurisdictions can enter into agreements with the Oregon Health Authority to support that. Finally, pleased to hear that we'll be addressing the issue around the fee being outlined in the bill and just hoping that we give the Oregon Health Authority and Department of Revenue the flexibility to increase that as needed so that we make sure we're covering the cost of this program and that it's effective. So we do think the bill needs a little bit of work, but we're eager to work with you and the stakeholders to move forward to come up with a good bill and would be looking forward to future conversations. And I think that's it. Thank you.
Would you let Ms. Callahan go first? Would like
yeah, Morgan and then.
Okay, well, that's fine. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Chair Monaz Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Morgan Cowling, and I am here on behalf of the Coalition of Local Health Officials, which represents the 34 local health departments operating across Oregon that work every day to protect the public's health and prevent the spread of disease. The Coalition of Local Health Officials supports statewide tobacco retail licensure, and we know that can be a powerful tool to protect communities. That said, I'm here to provide some feedback on LC 5. While we support the idea of statewide licensure, we too believe this bill still needs a little bit of work. First, just by way of background, we in all of our local health departments, we have tobacco prevention and education programs. Those, we call them TPEP, Tobacco Prevention and Education Programs. Their goal is to stop youth from getting hooked on tobacco. Our local health departments are charged with protecting the health of Oregonians and work tirelessly to create policies to restrict access to cigarettes and tobacco, and e-cigarettes and tobacco. And retail licensure is an important tool for these prevention efforts. Currently, we have 10 jurisdictions, both cities and counties, that operate a tobacco retail licensure program, so this is something that we're moving forward. You heard earlier from Chair Kafori about the efforts of Multnomah County, but they are not the only city and county that are currently operating a tobacco retail license program. So it's with that lens, too, of what's happening in our local communities that I provide our feedback. Unfortunately, in Oregon right now, it's too easy for kids to get access to cigarettes. The most recent CINAHR report, which is required by the feds, says that 1 in 5 children can access cigarettes. In addition, the SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, recommends tobacco retail licensure as one of the most important policies to prevent that youth access. So to get to our comments on LC5, there are a couple of areas. It sounds like you're already going to be addressing at least the setting the fee in statute. We, too, would have concerns about setting a fee of $300 in statute. We would worry that that would potentially put our administration and enforcement efforts at a disadvantage early on if we set the fee too low, that we wouldn't be able to carry out this important program. The next and I think probably biggest concern that we have right now is on the preemption. There are actually three preemptions in this bill. The first, as Mark Mayer mentioned, is that cities and counties cannot enact their own tobacco retail ordinance, which is a preemption on locals. The second is on the type of premise, and the third is on the location. We would recommend deleting the location and type of premise restrictions, preemptions, and then we would recommend a grandfather clause to allow a city or county that currently operates a licensure program to continue their program or opt for the statewide program. So if they had their ordinance in effect before this went into effect, they would have that option. And then throughout the bill, it does use enforcement language in some places and inspections language in other. We just would want the inspections language to be brought in to ensure that it could include other enforcement activities, including training and education. So throughout the bill, we would recommend that the language be strengthened to include administration and enforcement, including inspections, education and training, so that those activities are explicitly included in both DOR and Department of Revenue and the Oregon Health Authority activities. We too are very interested in passing statewide licensure in Oregon, and are ready to work with the chair and others on this important legislation. Thank you.
I would like to at least talk about location with you. And I understand the need to decrease access for our youth, but with the proliferation of charter schools, and charter schools are located in buildings, there are daycare centers, preschools that are located within downtown area. So if a local jurisdiction did set up 1,000 feet, even in the city of Gresham, my high school is in downtown Gresham, and so 1,000 feet includes a number of retail outlets, and so that is my concern, mainly with charter schools and preschools. And then those high schools that are located within a city, it would, that's one issue. And I'd like you to respond. And then the other regarding type of store, when we start getting into telling stores what they can sell or not sell is maybe that's a policy that Oregon wants to make, but I'm trying to find an outlet, or I want 16 votes out of the Senate. And so if we start narrowing in and having a preemption for those two issues, we're not going to have 16 votes in the Senate anyway. So I would like to have some creativity here. Should we be looking at a sunset? Are there other ways that we could pass the bill that we can maybe address location and preemption further down? Because I want a bipartisan bill, and we need to, I want to sort of have a, I want you to address that. Okay. Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Do you want them to answer your question,
yeah.
Madam
Would
Chair,
you
first?
Because
I'll be interested in your response.
Sure. Chair Monis Anderson, thank you for the question. I think the idea of preemption is, I think, as you know, will be a challenging one for us to find a middle ground on. I think that we have not seen a lot of preemptions that go into a place. It is very hard to reverse that. And the idea of 1,000 feet from a school in particular, we have at least one local tobacco retail ordinance that already has that in place. And so this would not only eliminate that local work. I think it would prevent other potential protection local ordinances that we may identify as good options in the future. So our concern is not only the current local ordinances, but what this would prevent us from being able to do in the future.
Thank you.
Chair Montes-Anderson, committee members, thank you for your question and, again, for your commitment to try and move something as quickly as we can to address tobacco use by kids. I'll echo what Morgan said and just add 2 points. One is that I feel, and the American Heart Association feels, for the last 50 years since the Surgeon General's first report on the harms of tobacco, that locally tailored policies that can respond to an evolving industry that is constantly coming up with new strategies like e-cigarettes, which we just saw, is at the heart of being able to protect our kids. And I think what you bring up is a valid concern about charter schools being in certain places and a high school next to a grocery store. And I think that those are concerns we would encourage local jurisdictions to be able to address and think about what the needs are in their community. And I know that one of the proposals in Multnomah County, not even endorsing it or doing otherwise, but just sharing information, was to grandfather in existing retailers and where they were located. And if that business was then sold, one of the proposals in front of Multnomah County that they were considering was that then that license could not be transferred to a new owner. So I think these are the kinds of solutions we want our local areas to be working on and thinking about. So I'll pause there. But I am happy to have more conversations about it.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, Ms. Higginbotham, you answered my question to some extent about the grandfather possibility, because that might be a place where we could get to a middle ground. So I'll be interested to hear from others who have this concern about whether that would address some of the preemption questions if we allow local jurisdictions to set location but grandfathered in existing ones and just didn't allow for transfer of licenses. My sense is that that would give flexibility to places like Gresham if it so chose to allow it, fine, or if it had big retailers near the high school and they were grandfathered in and they stayed there, okay. But in general, retailers are now starting to make choices about what they will or won't sell. I mean, we've seen, speaking of CVS, which we heard about earlier, they made a decision about 3 years ago not to sell tobacco products. And it's been, I've talked to some of their senior people, and it's been something of an economic hit. But overall, they think it's the right thing and it's congruent with their company's mission. They think it's oxymoronic to sell a product that hurts people while you're trying to sell products that help people. Mm-hmm. So, and we see other voluntary restrictions that we would encourage. I mean, you're not going to see pornographic material sold in most grocery stores, even if they sell lots of other magazines, because they've made a choice that that's not a family-friendly thing to do, even if they're legally allowed to do so. So encouraging retailers to do the right thing would be good. So if you agree that the grandfather is a possible middle ground, that's helpful to know. I mean, obviously, I understand it's not your preferred position, but if we could get to a place.
I need to cite another example, and I can only speak for my area. We are developing within 1,000 feet of a charter school. It's called the Cal Center. It's in we call it the Civic Center in Gresham, and there's a lot of undeveloped land, but it is a mall. And so I'm just trying to look at situations where charter schools, yes, they may stay in one place, but they also migrate, and there are preschools coming up all the time. So I think this is a very complicated issue, and I want to make sure that we're fair to business, but also my priority is the safety and the health of our youth in particular.
Okay, thank you. All right, let's go with Mel Rader and Sean Miller. Mel.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Mel Rader. I'm the Executive Director for Upstream Public Health. Also serve on the Steering Committee for the Oregon Health Equity Alliance, which is dedicated to improving the health and well-being of Oregonians. I'll, as public health organization, public health leader, tobacco, I very much support tobacco retail licensure. But it is a policy where it's really important to get the details right in order to have an effective system. I think there's many elements in here that do get it right and are very good, and there are also some areas of concern. And I'm just going to, without talking kind of about, tobacco statistics or why a tobacco retail system works, I'm just going to jump into some of the details. Want to reiterate some of the points that have been made before, in that a training and education system is critical, and that's important to be within the statute. When we're reviewing systems around the country, education and training is one of the most important components in order to have an effective system. We also worked with Multnomah County in doing assessments and visited many retail stores. We saw a tremendous amount of examples where stores were not in compliance with state and local laws, and they were mostly not in compliance with state and local laws because they didn't know what those laws were, and I think that's really important. And that's why an education and training system up front as a requirement for getting a license is really important, so that they know what the laws are and it's fair. It's also important that system is culturally responsive, so that we can provide those information and resources in different languages to address a variety of diverse businesses. I think how enforcement is done is critical. I'd like to see the initial inspections be randomized. There is some perception that we heard within the community that certain businesses were being targeted. Whether that's true or not, I think the perception is concerning, and it's important that we have a randomized system from the beginning. And then, of course, if a violation happens, then that goes into the enforcement procedures. In regards to the preemption clause, I think that needs some more work, needs more discussion. I'm not necessarily opposed to the first part, saying localities can't have their own licenses. There are some states that do that, like California, that has state licenses and local licenses. I think there are pros and cons to that. But the second part around businesses saying you can't, a locality cannot set restrictions on types of businesses or locations of businesses, is too broad. I think you've mentioned pharmacies, which is, a good discussion. I think there's also a lot of other examples that are probably less controversial, like looking at drive-thrus. There's nothing to that this my reading is that this would prohibit a locality from preventing drive-through purchases of tobacco products. And those drive-thrus are much harder to enforce and inspect compared to other systems of purchases. There's also concern around some of the within the vape industry around some of these garage manufacturers. So they're producing products out of their houses, and it might be in a mixed use zone, so not a totally residential zone, and they aren't having the same levels of standards of safety and accountability that other businesses have. I think those are just two examples of areas where it's important that localities have the ability to set restrictions around type of business and location. Those are the main points. I look forward to working with you in terms of improving this legislation. Thank you.
Great.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association. And my comments, on LC5, I think, I know the chairs and the committee's put a lot of work into this. We did participate in the Multnomah County ordinance discussion in several meetings and provided comments, and will participate in that rulemaking process. So we are a part of that particular process. But You know, as for LC5, you know, we did encourage Multnomah County to work with the legislature on a statewide proposal. You know, even though we were against the patchwork proposals of local governments putting together their own tobacco licensure program, we would much rather have a statewide program, licensure program, and that's why we're here today in discussions on LC5 and would like to see that move forward. You know, the members that I represent, particularly chain grocery stores that include pharmacies, chain pharmacies that I know has been a part of the discussion. You know, it seems like we have, you know, to have a consistent approach, I think this on page 7, a lot of discussion has been talked about on the preemption language in section 13, which is something that's imperative for us to be able to support this bill. We're very open to what Commissioner Kefouri mentioned in her testimony, given the changes that I think she mentioned. We are open to having those discussions and those changes within LC5. However, we would oppose the bill at this point if there's different revisions or deletions in the preemption provision, section 13. And I want to explain why. We believe that section 13 is a compromise on the preemption that we would like before. If we're going to create a statewide program that is out to get bad retailers that are selling to teens, and my members are supportive of that, we shouldn't have a patchwork of different licensure programs on top of that. But let me clarify that, because it was said before that if you look at the first preemption on the licensure program, I think when Multnomah County was putting together their program, because I asked a specific question, if the state passes their program, would you want a licensure program on top of that? And I think Senator Steiner Hayward was in the room. The answer was no. We would assume the statewide program. That is more efficient system. Obviously, there's enforcement. It's all the things. And we see this, based on what Multnomah County passed, them being able to do the same thing that Multnomah County wants to do in their program if this passes. And there's nothing in this licensure program. All this says is that you just can't have a duplicative licensure program. But I think all the enforcement, having the county health department work with the state, the resources that Multnomah County wants to dedicate towards this, which is fine to be involved in that licensure program, nothing in there prevents them from doing what they would like to do on enforcement. As for the sub 2 in section 13 dealing with type and location, that is a compromise. I mean, we would much rather have a consistent system and deal with policy in this building, for the entire program. However, nothing in this preemption language prohibits any local government from going above and beyond this on the product itself. So if there is correlation, and again, when we heard the arguments on all the things that they would like to do, if there's a correlation on certain tobacco products that are targeted to teens or that teens are buying, nothing in here would prevent them from actually doing something on their own. And I can see that as a correlation. What I cannot see, and what my members have a big problem with, and no one has proven that there's some form of correlation, that somehow location and the type of business, whether it's a pharmacy, has any correlation with the goal of getting, stopping teens getting that product. It's not like, And so I'll give an example. If for some reason pharmacy was a restriction in this bill, then all 46 of my member retailers in Multnomah County would be prohibited from selling tobacco. These are our large grocery stores who take a lot of pride in training their employees. They card. They have self-service. It's all behind the counter. It's locked product. And they make sure, and they take a lot of pride in making sure it's not getting into teens. So are they the bad guys? We're basically saying that they're presumed guilty just for selling the product. Now, if you show a correlation that they're the problem, then I understand that. But again, I think the whole point of a licensure program is to get the bad guys that are selling to teens, and my members are all supportive of it. If that's the goal, then let's move forward with this statewide program, and let's not presume that somehow responsible retailers are guilty, and then that just cuts them out of selling a legal product. So I think from the location, because of the way development is going nowadays, especially within urban areas, I would say, and a lot of my members are looking for properties and developing properties and putting grocery stores in, and they tell me on some of the restrictions, specifically to schools and other things that have been proposed, very difficult to build a property, and then they would be prohibited from selling, again, a legal product. It's like they're presumed guilty, before they're able to sell the product. Let's go after the bad people that are selling the product. Again, I'm here to in front of the committee to support that, but I would have some problems if, again, we remove this language, which I think represents a compromise on a very limited scope from our standpoint. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Miller, it occurs to me to wonder, is it possible for your organization to provide this committee with data on two separate aspects of tobacco sales by large grocers or by grocers in general? The first is, what percentage of their gross sales come from tobacco? And the second, which is actually a different question, obviously, what percentage of their profit? Because we understand that the grocery business, or I understand from conversations I've had with you and others, that the grocery business is understandably a low-margin business.
Mm-hmm. Very low margin.
Tobacco may fall into a very different category than that, and I don't know the answer to it. So it would be very helpful for me in understanding this issue if I could get some sense. As I said, I talked to CVS. They took a $1 billion hit from this, but they were prepared to do it. And that's a big, large, nationwide chain. So it's a little different. But I'm curious about what we're talking about in terms of percentages and numbers here, if that's possible.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Hayward, I'll check. They have a hard time often giving me those kinds of numbers just because they're proprietary to the business. But I can ask, and maybe I can get a range of percentages.
Even if I could get them in aggregate Oregon, that would be helpful.
I will
aggregate ask wouldn't violate anybody's.
Yeah, and I would say that, as for gross sales and percentage profits, yes, it's going to be a lower number than obviously the groceries and a lot of the main products compared to some retailers who may, tobacco may be a high percentage.
Understood.
But I guess that's to my point. What all we're asking for is some of the proposals have said that would cut us out completely from selling that product when we may not be the bad retailer selling to teens. And so I think I'll try to get that information for you, but I think that's all we're asking for. And I think in section 13.
And if I may, Madam Chair, the Health Authority, I believe, is not signed up to testify, but I will be asking them. They'll hear me ask it right now. If we can get a better breakdown on signer violations to understand what kinds of retailers are more prone to it. If the grocery stores percentage-wise are just as bad as everybody else, that's one thing. If they are, on the whole, much more compliant, that's a different issue. And I personally don't know that information, and I appreciate it. Help me think about this issue.
Any other? Okay. This is just another idea. I mean, I equate marijuana and tobacco on the same level. I hate both of them. I mean,
we, Madam Chair, we don't.
Okay. So the licensure the licensure
tobacco is more addictive.
Well, and we have pharmacies. We're regulated at the federal level under our pharmacies. So yeah, we.
But I am going to be asking Mark Mayer this question regarding a licensure of marijuana and how restrictive that is, since anyone really can set up a marijuana shop, and it is a gateway, and a lot of people, at least from the California study, or I guess studies that I've been reading, the increase in the use of marijuana in Colorado has just proliferated. And so, yes, we're. I don't want us to lose sight of, you know, just focusing on tobacco. It'd be great if we could eliminate tobacco, but now there's the marijuana, and where is the equality between those two? And that I will be checking with Mark on the licensure process there. Okay.
Thank you.
Does anyone else want to testify? Okay.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My apology, I missed the sign-up sheet this morning. For the record, my name is Luis Rodriguez. I'm with the American Cancer...
What are you speaking to?
Sorry, I'm speaking to LC5, Tobacco Retail Licensure. My name is Luis Rodriguez. I'm with the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for the state of Oregon. As many of my colleagues in the fight against tobacco have already spoken to, ACS CAN is very committed to reducing tobacco use. We see the burden of tobacco in Oregon, nearly 7,000 deaths this year that'll be attributed to tobacco use, and 68,000 Oregon children that are alive right now will die prematurely due to tobacco use as well. We remain committed to a statewide tobacco retail licensure program and recognize the importance of that in tobacco control. But I also want to echo the sentiments of those who have testified thus far as well, that ACS CAN would not be able to support a retail licensure system that has the preemptions that are outlined in Section 13, particularly around retail location, because we believe that localities should be able to determine if they want to adopt ordinances such as limiting the distance to schools. One thing that hasn't come up that I think is also important is around density restrictions that other municipalities have adopted. So we see that if there's a higher density of retailers within a particular area, children are more susceptible to marketing techniques as well, since the retailers are one of the main channels for tobacco retail marketing. So I just wanted to get on the record and let you all know our concerns around the preemption pieces, and looking forward to further discussion around that. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very much. All right. That concludes the informationals and all our LCs. I would like to open a work session for the purposes of introducing the committee measures. Senator Shields.
Madam Chair, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 38, dated 12/8/15; LC 153, dated 1/8/16; LC 155, dated 12/7/15.
Okay, Senator Shields moves that the LC 38, LC 153, LC 155 be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And this is Senator Shields' last health care committee. Right?
No. He's going to be here for this.
Oh, yeah, till the end of yeah, I forget.
He's just not running for re-election.
I was thinking that.
I was wondering if you knew something that I didn't know.
No.
A lot of wishful thinking probably in the room.
I was just thinking we were having a brand new session starting. That's totally wrong. Okay. Thank you, committee. And with that, we're adjourned.
I'm not dead yet. I'm not dead yet.